This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. On one issue, at least, State Representative Keith Summers says the new governor, J.B. Pritzker, was able to work across the aisle.
Give Governor Pritzker credit. His following through on that and having a conversation with me on that.
Summer talks about reforms at DCFS and other issues where he didn't see as much bipartisanship. Plus, President Dietz talks about what the new state budget and capital bill mean for Illinois State University, and meet a new Illinois Wesleyan grad who wrote his senior thesis on Frank Zappa. That after a GLT news update. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Illinois State University is among the public universities and colleges benefiting from increased appropriations in the state budget. GLT's Charlie Schlenker visits with ISU President Larry Dietz, who says the good news for ISU is a 5% increase in general state support.
It really means that this for FY 2020 will have $69.6 million. And to put that into context, stability is the most important thing, and we had a couple of years of budget impasse there that no one really, I think, thought did anybody any good. And so we're beyond that, and stability is an important thing, but also to put it into context, as we go back to what I think many folks have called the high water mark, which was it was a stability mark in FY15, and in that year we received $72 million. So we're still under FY15, but we're going in the right direction. So that's the most important thing, is that we have a budget, and it's above where it was last year, so we're celebrating that.
Concerning the capital appropriation, ISU has been promised money for the fine arts complex for nigh on to a decade now.
Right.
Can you really count on it?
Well, I think so. Revenue sources have to be identified. There have to be casinos built, and next fall, they'll vote on the fair tax bill. All of us will vote on that next fall. So it's not like we have money in the bank today. We won't have money in the bank for any of these projects until, revenue sources have been identified. But they have been identified, and my sense is that we're marching in the right direction with all of that. And so we're optimistic that that money will come through.
What did Milner get for an appropriation in the capital bill?
$89.2 million. That figure has been a part of our capital request for a long time. Milner is an aging facility, and the way students have used libraries in the now versus in the past, whenever Milner was built, it was a fine facility and still is a fine facility. The bones at Milner are very, very good. But students learn in different ways now, and we still need the resource librarians to help them with discipline-related research that they might be doing. But they're working in groups now a lot more than they did whenever I was a student, for example. And as a result of that, the structure inside of libraries is changing. So a big chunk of that money would be used to restructure the interior of the library and add some technological enhancements. And we have a consultant that's helped us with a report. So as soon as we get the money, we're, as they say, shovel ready. Or in this case, it probably won't be shovel as much as it will be removing some and renovating some things on the inside.
Back on the general state aid appropriation, what will that allow ISU to do that it hasn't been able to do?
Well, I think some of that will certainly help us with some additional deferred maintenance issues, though we have also received an additional $40 million in capital expenditures for deferred maintenance. But we've been having to take deferred maintenance costs out of the general operating funds. And so hopefully we'll be able to pull back on some of our general operating money and use some of this additional money for some of that deferred maintenance. But it also will help us with technology. It'll help us with faculty hires and areas of growth. And so, we also don't want to get carried away because 5% is not a huge amount of money overall in terms of the entire operating budget.
To put that $40 million in deferred maintenance capital money into perspective, what is the total deferred maintenance for the campus at the moment?
We're about $400 million. That has been building up over time. We've tried to commit some money to that, but the oldest public university in the state of Illinois, as you might imagine, our buildings are older than most of the other buildings on all the other campuses in the state, so that's always a challenge for us. And so that amount is something that we've been trying to pare down a little bit, but $40 million would certainly help us pare that down considerably.
So the general state aid money will help hire faculty in areas where there is growth. ISU has, for a number of years, been under what's kind of called a soft freeze. It's not an official freeze, but you have to okay every single position that comes up for a hire and say no or okay, yeah, that's justified. Is that softening with this, or is that the policy going forward that it'll be a no growth unless it's really demonstrated?
Well, I think that's been part of our strength. We're kind of a steady Eddie, careful, conservative kind of institution, and I think that's really paid off for us. The positions, for example, that are approved start at the department level, work their way up through appropriate deans and vice presidents and so forth up to my desk. And so protocol, really, it's not a policy, but really more of an internal protocol, it also keeps me informed about where we're having turnover. Because I see all of those, I can ask some questions down then. And, there are occasions where I'll question hires, and sometimes I'll question vacancies to make sure that we're meeting needs. But, for the most part, those positions have been well vetted at the departmental level and at the unit level. And so by the time it gets to me, I don't turn down a lot. I have. But it really keeps me informed, and I think it's another way for all of us to continue to be good stewards of the money.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Our guest today is Illinois State University President Larry Dietz. Another aspect of the state budget is an increase in MAP money, student aid money. What will that give to ISU in terms of flexibility for financial aid?
Well, the MAP dollars obviously go with the students, and so it's not an appropriation for the institution, but the MAP eligibility follows the student. And so we anticipate that because our enrollment for this fall, we have a very vibrant freshman population coming in, so we anticipate that we're going to get our fair share of the MAP dollars as students enroll here in good numbers. What it really means, though, is that more students potentially will be eligible for MAP. In the past, due to lack of funding, only about half the students who actually applied and qualified for MAP received it because of lack of funding. So an additional $50 million will certainly help us help all students. And our concern is that some students probably may not have been going anywhere because if they didn't get the MAP, they just didn't feel like that they had a shot at anything. With this additional money, hopefully more students will be able to enroll at their institution of choice, and ISU's been an institution of choice, so I think that we'll do well with that. Put that in context also, about 4,000 students receive a MAP this past year, and that's about $22 million in MAP funding for the university. So we're just thrilled about that, and are very pleased that the governor and the legislature have recognized that as an important resource for students.
If the new MAP money were to track out proportionally, how much of that MAP money or how many extra students would ISU probably attract because of the $50 million increase?
Yeah, we haven't. I haven't been involved in the discussions. I've got a cabinet meeting in the morning, and we'll probably talk about that a little bit in the morning. but I haven't been a part of any simulations, but I wouldn't be surprised with the increase in our freshman population that we might get a couple more $1 million than we're used to getting on that.
And what is that increase in freshman student population? What's the enrollment looking like, even though you have to wait for show rates
sure,
at the 10th
sure.
day following the start of the fall semester? You must have at least a thumbnail sketch.
Sure. Well, for the first time since I've been here, and I've been here now 8 years, 6 years in this role, and for the first time in my memory of being here, we've had to go back and adhere to the May 1 application priority deadline because we simply had more students than we felt that we could accommodate. And so some have been put on some waiting lists and so forth, but we adhere to that May 1 date. And so we anticipate that our freshman numbers may be up around 4,100. So overall population, we anticipate still being in that high 20s or low 21,000 number.
4,100 compared to what last year?
About 38.
That'll provide some funding stability, but will it change the nature of what departments are being asked to do? Are there concentrations on that particular cohort?
Yeah, one of the things that we're finding is that some of our new programs like cybersecurity are really growing by leaps and bounds. And so we have, some areas that are, clearly high-demand areas. But overall, I think it goes back to the fact that we have a budget, and our admissions folks and all of our enrollment management people work very hard about bringing in our population here. But I think also the state having a budget and having an increase in funding, I think, sends a positive message to parents and prospective students that they need to stay in state and go to school at an in-state institution. So in terms of a brand, our brand has been very, very strong even in tough times. And so I think we're just continuing to reap the rewards of having a terrific product, which is a fine education from a fine institution.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Larry Dietz is the president of Illinois State University. He's with us today. The General Assembly approved legalized recreational marijuana. That complicates life for all public universities who receive federal funds because the feds are not all okay with legalized marijuana. How do you think you will have to finesse that or adjust to it or craft policies and protocols going forward?
Well, again, this will be a topic for a cabinet meeting in the morning. Tomorrow's going to be a busy morning, but we're going to have discussions about this throughout the summer and really throughout the fall and trying to educate our students, faculty, and staff and our overall population about what are the do's and don'ts related to this new law. But we still have to comply with the Federal Drug-Free Workplace Act and the Drug-Free Schools and Communities Act. So, those federal laws really, have precedent over the state laws in that area. We also have a smoke-free campus policy, and so it doesn't mean that people are going to be free to light up a joint wherever they want to do that. So we have particular laws and protocols that we're going to continue to follow. But clearly, we're going to have a lot of discussions with our student affairs staff, our academic affairs staff, our university police, human resources, athletics, all the student body. I think we're going to be in the discussion stage all summer and probably throughout the fall trying to formalize issues. I have gone to a meeting in Denver within the last several months, and there are a lot of opportunities to purchase product in Colorado. And I've also talked to some folks out there who are involved with the law in Colorado, and I hope what will happen is that eventually we'll get to the point where, kind of the shock value will wear off, and that this will be something that if folks want to purchase and use, that they'll know what the rules under which they're using that, and it will become more of a regular way of doing business, if you will, versus kind of the shock value that here we are and we're looking at this as predominantly a revenue source, and while it would probably will be a good revenue source. There are implications, and we're just now beginning to talk about those implications.
How do you want to structure the campus dialogue on this? You mentioned all the stakeholders, but Where does it start? How do you want to make it flow from one stakeholder to another and then back up to you through the other academic departments?
You know, I think this summer will be a time for our general counsel and the stakeholders that I mentioned to get together and try to figure out as well as we can, you know, what are our rules and then how to publicize those rules. Students can have need to be a part of that discussion, but the law is the law, and so we'll have to enforce state law on this, and as well as the federal law. So the main thing is letting students know what the rules are. So whenever we start this fall, that we can all start together and hopefully eliminate any unfortunate circumstances. But I think students will need to be a part of that discussion, but they're mostly not here this summer, though we have some folks around that we can talk with our student body presidents around this summer, and I think we'll involve her in some initial conversations about this.
Republican Congressman Rodney Davis came up last week to talk about a number of topics, but he indicated he would support medical marijuana permissions at the federal level. Do you have a sense of how that would play out if it were ever to become a conversation at the congressional level on ISUs or other higher education campuses?
I really haven't. Congressman and I talk fairly recently. We talked at May commencement when his daughter graduated, but we talked about the celebration at that time, not about medical marijuana, obviously. So I've not had conversations with him about this topic in particular.
Illinois State University President Larry Dietz, thanks so much for joining us.
Always a pleasure. Thanks, Charlie.
I'm Charlie Schlenker.
ISU has also been involved in a multi-year comprehensive campaign. President Dietz says they're now at about $142.5 million toward the $150 million goal. He says there are about 13 months left in the campaign. Dietz says they'll celebrate a multi-million dollar gift to be made public in September. 50,000 people have donated to the campaign, and 29,000 of them are new donors. After a break, more reaction on the spring legislative session from the two House Republicans who represent Bloomington Normal. This is Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from Mackinac Valley Vineyard and Winery, open daily. Offerings include wine tastings, gift shop, outdoor concert Saturday evenings, special events, and space available for private parties, weddings, and wedding receptions. MackinacValleyVineyard.com. Wine country in your own backyard. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. After years of struggling to enact a historic overhaul of the state's school funding structure, Illinois lawmakers this session focused on other major initiatives like abortion, cannabis, casinos, and a new income tax system. But public schools are facing another growing problem that lawmakers haven't quite figured out how to fix. IPR education reporter Dusty Rhodes explains.
In radio, we try not to spout a lot of numbers because those tend to go in one ear and out the other. So let's just say when the General Assembly adjourned a few days ago, public schools were set to receive $8.8 billion, virtually every penny they requested. But there are some problems money alone can't solve.
The biggest discussion over the Capitol for K-12 education really focused around the teacher shortage.
That's Amanda Elliott, Director of Legislative Affairs for the State Board of Education.
This is something that has been discussed for the last several years.
And yet the shortage, already severe, is getting worse. According to a recent survey, more than 85% of school superintendents say they have trouble hiring teachers.
Last year, the legislature passed a law that allowed for reciprocity.
So now anyone who holds a teacher license in another state automatically qualifies for a credential here. That change brought Illinois a 20% bump in applications.
This year, the conversation really focused around testing. We had two bills passed that eliminate the basic skills test.
That's a test introduced in the 1980s. It's been revamped three times, making it increasingly difficult. 75% of potential teachers flunk the test, which means they aren't even allowed to take teacher prep courses. Lawmakers also considered eliminating the two other big tests required for a teaching license.
There were different iterations of bills that were filed that eliminated content tests and the teacher performance assessment altogether. But eventually we landed on just eliminating the basic skills test and studying content tests.
Kyle Thompson is assistant regional superintendent of a 7-county area in East Central Illinois, and he has so many teacher vacancies, he traveled to Springfield to testify against what he regards as excessive teacher testing twice. He says killing that basic skills test just isn't enough.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, for all the effort that was put in throughout this spring session, I just don't feel like we came out with enough solutions or as great of an impact as we could have and should have.
Thompson blames colleges that run teacher preparation programs. Their officials showed up en masse to testify against the bill Thompson supported, which would have eliminated all three tests.
I'll never forget sitting in that room, and then 10 or 12 different university professors or deans or whatever went up and stood around that table first. You were in the room. And that was the group that, you know, was advocating essentially for status quo.
Elliot, whose job is essentially to act as the ambassador in charge of negotiations between lawmakers and the state board, admits more changes are needed.
Eliminating the basic skills test, I think, will help, but it is only one small component. We really need to have additional conversations about other barriers to the teaching field. I think another bill that passed that will help the teacher shortage is the minimum teacher salary bill, making sure that teachers are paid what they deserve, I think is important and will hopefully help encourage more people to come to the field. Other things that need to be looked at include pensions, working conditions, respect for the profession. And those are all really, big rocks that will take time to evaluate and address.
In her calm, diplomatic tone, she points out that one new measure requires the state board to review content area tests to see whether some need to be updated or scrapped. Thompson, whose job includes helping find teachers for schools in 25 rural districts, sounds more like that student who legitimately needs a fidget spinner.
I feel like we're always creating task force and forming committees. I feel like it just takes so long. And every year we do this, it's just another year of our lives and our efforts just not filling positions in rural areas, And so, I get it. I'm sure they'll do the task force. I'm sure they'll come up with some solutions, I hope. I guess I'm just baffled. I just don't think all the people that were in such opposition to all these changes, I don't think they realize how bad it is.
IPR's Dusty Rhodes reported that story. Staying in Springfield, the spring legislative session wrapped up last week. Democrats are calling it one of the most productive sessions in history. GLT's Mary Cullen talks with House Deputy Republican Leader Representative Dan Brady about his perspective from across the aisle.
Overall, it went about as good as it could have. Isn't perfect, but absolutely, it's something that reflects the fact that honest compromise is seldom perfect.
Pritzker actually started his term by vowing to work across the aisle. How do you think he worked to include Republicans in discussions despite having a Democratic majority in both the House and the Senate?
Well, there were times when that was followed through, and there was times when that wasn't followed through. And one of those times was the minimum wage bill, where our input was not sought, and our ideas and different ideas to try and soften some of the minimum wage blow was not part of anything at all. Then we go to budget negotiations, and then there is a little more involvement and improvement as far as being in the minority, in my opinion, goes. But to Governor Pritzker, certainly his style and his personality and his ways of communicating are obviously different than Governor Rauner's were.
Right. Now,
and I say that in a positive sense as far as that goes.
Could you expand on that a little bit, why you think it's so positive?
Sure. I think it's positive only because he did reach out on certain occasions, not with certain pieces of legislation. Again, I point to the minimum wage, but budget negotiations towards the end, there was input, there was compromise, and that made for a better product. Not perfect, better end product.
So now, restating what you just said, at beginning of session, that was when we had the minimum wage increase bill on the floor. There wasn't a lot of bipartisan work there. And then towards the end here at the May, what was that, the 32nd day of May, when we had more bipartisan work on the Capitol bill. So do you think that, does that give you hope for next year, potentially?
Well, I'm an internal optimist, so I always have hope. You have to in this line of work. But I do have you know, hope. I hope that in the election cycle that will be upcoming, that there's some change in numbers for the Republicans in the House and the supermajority that we find ourselves in. We'd like to change that, obviously, and we'd be more of a certainly a force to be reckoned with. But with that being said, what we were able to do was come together in areas that were very important in the budget process. And one of those areas where I serve as minority spokesman on appropriations higher education was for higher education. And for the university that I represent, Illinois State University, that was treated, quite frankly, remarkably well in the budget.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mary Cullen speaking with State Representative Dan Brady for a wrap-up of the spring legislative session. Hot topic measures were passed, including raising the minimum wage, legalized marijuana, the Reproductive Health Act, a gambling expansion, and, of course, the Capitol bill. Now, Democrats are calling it one of the most productive sessions in Illinois in recent years. Would you agree with that?
I don't know that I would say the most productive, but it was a positive step. We were able to come to an agreement, especially when you talk about in the area of capital, and realize the fact that you know our state hasn't had a capital bill since I think 2009, and over $27 billion of deferred maintenance is just the starting point, if you will. And so, being able to you know come to terms with that, understand that, and that you know you're not going to change that unless you make investment into the state, and that's what we did as Republicans and as Democrats, and so that's positive. And those positives come back home to Illinois State University that I represent when you talk about capital.
Now, it was a long spring session. I mean, who knew that May had 33 days? But the fall veto session is going to be here before we know it. Are there any bills that you have your eye on?
Well, in particular, I think that we will find that we'll be doing some budget cleanup. There's never been a time that I've been involved in a budget where when we come back in the fall, there's not some amendment or changes that goes on to the budget. And I would imagine we will have that as well. I think also looking at maybe specific legislation, one of the pieces of legislation that stalled in the Senate was the Floyd Card Act dealing with gun ownership, transfer, et cetera. And so I think that that will be something that could be back to see us. And always something in the fall veto, you're supposed to be dealing with that. Vetoes by the governor on legislation, whether you're going to override or not. But fall veto sessions sometimes have a way of having new bills introduced. And so I have to wait and see what the Democrat majority might do in that respect. But I think that as any veto session is, it will be one thing where you kind of take it every day at a different time.
GLT's Mary Cullen speaking with State Representative Dan Brady. The other House Republican who represents parts of Bloomington Normal is Keith Summer. And Summer says the first person he talked to back in his district after spring session complained about all the things lawmakers didn't address: pension reform, workers' compensation, and property tax relief. Summer tells GLT's Eric Stock the claims of bipartisanship that seemed to fill Springfield was a bit overblown.
Well, those that said they felt it towards the end of the session, I would disagree a bit. I think that the majority being such a supermajority, this General Assembly, the Republicans, at least in the House, didn't have a great deal of substantial input. And actually, it came down the last few days where the majority was looking to get Republican votes on some of these bills, where they agreed to some concerns that some of our larger businesses had. And those were addressed in a bill, and I think that's what led some Republican support of some of the measures.
Did that surprise you that some Republicans did go along in the end siding with Democrats?
Doesn't surprise me, no. I think we could have held out and done a little better. Then there are those who say, well, take what you can on those business reforms as they were and go from there. I wasn't sure that agreement itself would come to fruition. But I think the fact that Governor Pritzker comes from a different perspective than particularly the two previous Democrat governors led him to probably agree to those measures.
Now, some of those pro-business reforms, I think you're referring to the Blue-Collar Jobs Act, attracting large-scale construction projects, the data center tax initiative to enhance the state's ability to locate data centers by providing tax incentives, and there are some others. Are there any in particular there that stand out to you as beneficial to the state and any that you would have supported if it were perhaps standalone?
Well, I think most of those are beneficial. I think they probably benefited our larger employers. One of the proposals would take the sales tax off of products or say inputs in the manufacturing process. It's something that is not taxed in agriculture, and we've had that fight over the years where various administrations wanted to put that sales tax on inputs. Well, this is kind of comparable to that, and I think that's very beneficial.
As you had alluded to, Democrats use their supermajorities to push through a lot of their policy initiatives. But as you know, one party rule doesn't always mean a harmony. Some Chicago Democrats don't have the same value system as some downstate Democrats. That played out in the marijuana issue, for example. But unlike previous years, it didn't hold everything up. Why do you think that is?
Well, I was surprised that the gaming actually was passed, and historically, gaming legislation is so burdened with so many different proposals and people wanting benefits, but I think the minority community in Chicago held out on that until they got some what they wanted on gaming and in the marijuana legislation, and it probably led then to support for the overall budget and capital plan.
What are your concerns about the marijuana legislation and also the gambling expansion?
Well, I don't partake in either. Those who I spoke to about marijuana, early in three camps, the medical community. I've had a number of physicians and medical providers tell me, don't go that route, please don't do it, particularly as early as the age of 21, the brain's still developing. So the medical community, I've never had one physician tell me to vote for that. You also have the law enforcement community, which is concerned about the effects of consumption of marijuana and how that plays on public safety and driving. We're not sure where that's going to lead. And thirdly, the employers of our state who anecdotally now tell me in my community they have difficulty filling many jobs they have because current applicants can't pass drug tests. So my thought on that is if currently they can't find enough applicants to pass a test and now recreational marijuana is available at 21, how many are you going to pass in the future? And the legislation allows the employer to continue those practices.
Are they doing that at their own peril, though, turning away prospective employees because of that?
Let me give you an example. I got a letter from OSF saying not only the medical portion of the question, but as an employer and the importance of the functions performed by so many of their employees, that they were very strongly against recreational marijuana as an employer.
And this is Hound Ideas. I'm Eric Stock with State Representative Keith Sommer, a Republican from Morton in the 88th Legislative District. If we can shift gears to the new Capitol bill, the first that Illinois has had in 10 years, and it's a concept that it seemed to have bipartisan support, though, of course, the funding sometimes gets messy. Is there a better way to fund it than a near 20-cent increase in the gas tax and vehicle registration increases and the cigarette tax hike?
Well, there are a number of taxes that are purportedly to go into it. I agree with those who think that the motor fuel tax and the vehicle registration tax is somewhat regressive. It actually targets those who need something. It's not like a tax on, say, marijuana, which is a choice, or a tax on gambling, which is a choice, or a tax on whether it be cigarettes or alcohol consumption, which are personal choices, yet every individual needs that transportation. And unfortunately, it's those at the lower economic end who bear the brunt of it because it's a greater portion of their budget.
Is there another way that you would find the money for a capital plan that seems that everyone figures needs to get done?
We haven't found that, yeah. And unfortunately, it seems to be, and people I talk to and who I run into are frustrated as individuals. They say, yes, I can see a capital program. My university benefits, my social service providers benefit, but I don't feel that I benefit individually and that I'm paying these hundreds and hundreds of extra dollars a year that I don't think I'm going to get in return. Even if the graduated tax takes place and passes, the supposed benefit to property taxes is not something that would even come close to what I'm paying on these other fees.
How do you feel that this first term of the legislature reflects on Governor Pritzker in his first few months of dealing with lawmakers in Springfield and getting a lot of what he wanted done?
Well, I can't speak for other legislators, but I can speak for myself in that Governor Pritzker engaged every legislator. Actually, you had the opportunity, if you wish, to visit with him, and I did on a number of occasions. And very amiable, very personal. Was able to discuss issues of detail, of concern, and to joke. And he was someone you would be comfortable with. And that's not been the case with recent governors.
Now, I know that didn't cause you to vote for what he wanted, but do you think that helped him get yes votes?
Oh, certainly. And I had a conversation with him about a different topic, which is usually not in the headlines, but was briefly this year, DCFS. And the deaths of children who are under the care of the state of Illinois in most circumstances, but have died at the hands of either family members or others connected to the family. And we've tried to address that issue. And I give Governor Pritzker credit. It's his following through on that and having a conversation with me on that. I'm the Republican spokesman on the committee that deals with child welfare. And there was an occasion where he was making a press announcement about what he was going to do. And after we had met, he directed his staff to call me before the press announcement so that I knew what was transpiring. And that meant a lot to me, that you build a relationship in dealing with that issue. So that was important to me.
That was Keith Sommer, an 11-term Republican state representative with GLT's Eric Stock. Sommer backed a measure which lawmakers approved to require clergy to report child abuse, not just sexual abuse. DCFS got an $89 million funding increase in this year's budget, partly to hire more investigators. This is Sound Ideas.
Partnering with GLT works for Specs Around Town.
I just feel that the GLT listeners, the audience, are somewhat the influencers in our community.
Hi, my name's Julie Kupsch, and I'm the owner of Specs Around Town.
A GLT underwriter for almost two decades.
Our clients are people that realize the importance of shopping local.
Partnering with GLT works for Specs Around Town. Find out how it can work for you at WGLT.org.
Support for GLT comes from Monkey Duck Marina, just a little beyond normal on Lake Bloomington, offering pontoon, bass boat, canoe, and kayak rentals for sport, leisure, or fishing. Services include concessions, bait, and propane. Details at monkeyduckmarina.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Every week or so, we've been bringing you the story of an unsung community servant who's making Bloomington Normal a better place. It's a feature we call More of That, Please. Today, we're introducing you to Tamika Newman, who's helping low-income Bloomington Normal residents navigate the justice system. GLT student reporter Tiffany Jackson has the story.
When navigating the justice system, defending yourself while trying to understand the legal process can be very frustrating. Acknowledging the barriers faced by low-income defendants in the 1963 Gideon decision, the Supreme Court declared that the Sixth Amendment will require states to provide legal counsel for criminal defendants who can't afford an attorney. Tamika Newman says that this still leaves a gap.
But if you are dealing with something civil, like a restraining order or expungements or anything like that, then you kind of, and you don't have the money, then you just kind of have to rely on yourself, and that can be a very difficult and scary thing.
Newman graduated from ISU last year with a degree in criminal justice. Newman now works for Illinois Justice Corps, which places college students and graduate volunteers in courthouses throughout the state. They help people who may be involved in lawsuits without a lawyer navigate the system and create a less intimidating environment. Newman is stationed at the McLean County Law and Justice Center. She can give legal advice, but she helps people by guiding them to the correct courtrooms, assisting with forms, or finding a court service.
A young woman came in and she wanted to do an expungement for her criminal record. She had got arrested and how she basically committed theft because she didn't have money to feed her children. She had to do what she did in order for her children to pretty much to survive, and that was the way that she put it for me. That kind of just opened my eyes because I am a really strong believer of the justice system and laws, and you shouldn't do things, and you know the law can be very black and white, but there are a lot of gray areas. Not saying that what she did was appropriate, but I'm happy and I'm proud that I have a passion for a judicial system or a law, like a legal system that allows you to take your mistakes and kind of erase them.
After finishing her stint with Justice Corps in August, Newman will move to Chicago and search for a position as a legal assistant until starting law school next year. She wants to start off as a public defender.
And eventually I do want to open my own law firm, so I want to be able to take what I learned here as far as like the importance of pro bono and being available and being able to provide a service for others free of charge. And I want to do that for others and just like help people get through obstacles in their life.
Anyone seeking guidance on a current case can find Newman on Mondays and Wednesdays at the Law Library at the McLean County Law and Justice Center. For The Leadoff, I'm Tiffany Jackson.
This story debuted this morning on GLT's The Leadoff podcast. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or NPR One. Learn more at WGLT.org/leadoff. This is Sound Ideas. Recent Illinois Wesleyan University graduate Brandon Chopp concluded that after he wrote his senior thesis on Frank Zappa, he perceived the provocative songwriter in a less flattering light than when he began the project. Chopp recently answered our call for What's on Your Turntable. From his home in Gardner, Illinois, Chopp shared with GLT's John Dorton some late 1960s Zappa cuts he highlighted in his paper that earned him the school's Phi Beta Kappa Liberal Arts Scholar Award.
So we're listening to the album Freak Out from Frank Zappa, The Mothers of Invention, 1966 album. What was the reasoning behind writing about Zappa?
I found Frank Zappa's music to be very different from the other music at the time. It was very critical of the audience that was listening to his records, as well as of the country, in a more comical stance even compared to other protest music of the time. Right now we're listening to Who Are the Brain Police, which is the third track from Freak Out.
And the plastics all melted, and so is the chrome. Who are the brain police?
So the song is Who Are the Brain Police, Frank Zappa, The Mothers of Invention, the 1966 Freak Out album. Brandon, what got you about this song?
Well, this song I kind of felt encapsulated much of his criticism of the country. The song deals with mass conformity through the metaphor of plastic. Plastic in the 1960s kind of represented the commodifiable, conformable person in the culture, because at this time, plastic was used in items of mass consumerism, and therefore that kind of idea can be translated over to people. And so Zappa took this song and created a dystopia of plastic.
Were the plastic that melted and the chromium too?
Each verse ends with this kind of taunting, mocking question of who are the brain police that are the creators of this plastic dystopia that he describes in the verses. In the song, it never gets answered, but that's because the answer, which he stated about 20 years later in an interview, was that we ourselves are the brain police because we had been policing our own brains to conform to social and cultural norms that resulted in a conformist population.
Frank Zappa and the Mothers of Invention from the album Freak Out. It's a 1966 release. This is GLT Sound Ideas. And what's on your turntable? Late 60s Zappa is. Brandon Chopp, who lives in Gardner, a recent Illinois Wesleyan grad, is taking us through this. He answered our call when we asked, what's on your turntable? Brandon said, Zappa. So let's talk a little bit more about the idea that Zappa was rebelling or at least critiquing the conformity of America. You want to take us to another song?
This album works.
Okay, so we're still on Freak Out. What song do you want to play next?
Return of the Son of Monster Magnet. So this song is perhaps the polar opposite of Who Are the Brain Police, and they both appeared on the same record. He called it what freaks sound like at 3 in the morning with $500 worth of rented percussion. It really is just a kind of a montage of the hippies of Los Angeles doing whatever they do. They are, in essence, freaking out, which would, to Zappa, was basically the essence of individuality, which was his solution to conformity. So these freaks, the noises you are hearing, they're just doing whatever they want. They're chanting. There's some indications of an orgy. There's a lot of avant-garde, musique concrète, technical aspects, some weird sounds that really weren't on the radio at this time.
Well, Brandon, let me throw this in there. He was coming of age at a time when the hippie movement was coming of age, and by many people, he was probably confused as a hippie, especially from the older people at the time, but he had some pretty pointed critiques of the hippie movement itself, did he not?
Yes, he did. He really went after the hippies probably in his third album, We're Only In It For the Money. Who Needs the Peace Corps? It's the second song on the album.
What's there to live for? Who needs the Peace Corps? Think I'll just drop out. I'll go to Frisco Bio.
And that really is kind of his general overarching critique of the conformity within the counterculture movement. Because, of course, Zappa had a keen eye for conformist aspects, and he saw hippies, especially in San Francisco, as kind of exhibiting mass conformity through their obsession with drug consumption or Zen religion.
I'll stay a week and get the crabs and take a bus back home. I'm really just a phony, but forgive me, cause I'm stoned.
And so this song takes place right after the Summer of Love in 1967, when a lot of disaffected kids from around the country flocked to San Francisco to take a part of this scene. And this song kind of tells the story of a hippie hopeful who went there and is really ignorant of the scene, but still goes around and tries to do all of the hippie things, like dancing at the Fillmore or buying a wig to look like a hippie with long hair. But at the same time, this hippie's ignorance is kind of well known in the song, because this person goes to ask the Chamber of Commerce where Hite Street is, which is the center point of the hippie counterculture in San Francisco.
Go to San Francisco.
First I'll buy some beads, and then perhaps a leather band to go around my head.
Brandon Chopp, living in Gardner, Illinois Wesleyan recent grad on GLT Sound Ideas. It's What's on Your Turntable? Late 1960s, Frank Zappa and the Mothers of Invention is what he's got going. Frank Zappa, really interesting guy. He was always railing against conformity, railing against education, against the mass media, parents and how they treated their children. What kind of political leanings, if any, did he have at that time?
So at that time, I'm not really sure what Zappa's exact political leanings were, but in his autobiography about 20 years later, he identified himself with kind of the goals of libertarians and this kind of political propulsion of individuality, kind of just let people do their things but guide them as necessary. At this time in Absolutely Free, he had a really interesting song that kind of attacked political leaders and how they were hypocritical in their lawmaking. So Brown Shoes Don't Make It, it's the penultimate cut of Absolutely Free.
Brown shoes, don't make it. Quit school, why fake it? Brown shoes,
So, Brandon, from the time you began to write your thesis paper to, say, now, what's different about your view of Frank Zappa compared to now?
So I found that he was just a little bit hypocritical and very much not easy to get along with, especially in the way that he enacted his thoughts in his music, because they really were kind of lashing out against the same people who bought it in really offensive ways. They also had a lot of subject matter that was pretty offensive and not really necessary to say the things he wanted to say. And at the same time, he would criticize these elements of society that he saw as conforming the nation, but he would use them to his own advantage. He very much believes in capitalism, and he liked his money very much. And he would use those measures he criticized to earn the money that he wanted, all in the name of just trying to make music the way that he wanted to do.
That's recent Illinois Wesleyan University grad Brandon Chopp speaking from Gardner with GLT's John Norton on What's on Your Turntable. Chopp earned the Phi Beta Kappa Award at Illinois Wesleyan for his senior thesis on late 1960s Frank Zappa. Drop us a line at WGLT.org and let us know what's playing on your turntable. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. WGLT.org is where you can find Sound Ideas interviews today with help from Charlie Schlenker, Mary Cullen, Eric Stock, John Norton, and Tiffany Jackson. I'm Ryan Denham. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org. Bloomington Normal's public media.